We switch all our computers in the office because now we use Apples for everything. Order entry, invoicing, following up on the orders. As long as the computers are running, the factory is running. As long as the factory is running, we're making products every day. That's why I'm the only umbrella manufacturer left in the United States. I can't believe that I didn't switch from the PCs to the iMac sooner. I can't believe how fabulous they work. If you have a small business, get a Mac. There's no question about it. My name is Richard Ziskin, and my dream is that it rains every single day.
Hello, and welcome to the Podcast Plus 30 Plus Minute Album Conversation you're going to hear all week long. I'm your host, Irfan Elijah. Joining me today, when he's not slapping around Cult of Mac writers, you'll find him slapping the bass in America's hottest all-accordion band, Lewis Wallace is here.
Very hot and sweaty, yes. It's great to be back.
Also joining us, he's currently spending his time finishing up his new Apple book with occasional breaks to cry uncontrollably in the shower. Lewis Caney is here.
That's exactly right. How did you know?
Well, we've seen you through a few books. We've gotten the back story, and I know that you like to spend some time crying when you're finishing up these books.
Oh, God, crying in the shower, in the car, in bed, at breakfast, in front of the kids, in front of the TV, and at work.
Which is perfectly acceptable for the amount of stress.
I'm dehydrated, sure. Yeah.
He is drinking lots of Gatorade to keep himself nice and hydrated during these tough emotional times. So Leander is wrapping up his new Tim Cook book, which features all of Tim's favorite Thanksgiving recipes. It's going to be a very hot seller. When is this book coming out, Leander?
April.
Wait a second. It's due in April? Why are you so stressed about it now?
It's not due in April. They've got to print the thing.
Okay, so when do you actually have to turn it in?
Monday.
They need that much time to get it ready for press?
Yeah. I don't know. The writing deadline was, this past April. This is the editing deadline, now it's going through the edit.
It's going to take that long to edit the book?
Yeah, they have long lead times.
Like maybe it's because they've sampled your writing before and they know how much editing this is going to take.
That might be right, yes.
13 seconds per typo.
We've done LK's books before. We're going to need at least 9 months to put this thing in any kind of shippable shape. We've got 17 editors all standing by. So, well, that would be great. Once that's turned in, you can go back to doing what you love, which is napping at your desk and going to the pub.
That's right.
Well, we've got all sorts of Apple news to talk about this week. We scoured Cult of Mac for all the best stories, and here's what we have for you. The iPhone XS, we've got some news about that, and I've got some very good news about pricing that you may like very much. We'll share that with you. The Apple Watch may get the one feature I have always wanted it to have. I'll tell you about that. And we're going to wrap up the show with Leander's interview with Ken Kosienda. He was an Apple developer, right? Caney? Apple developer is the correct way to describe him. And he was involved in the creative process behind the iPhone, the iPad, Safari. And Leander got him on the line for a one-on-one interview about Apple's creative process, their secret sauce, as Leander said earlier. And he's going to share some of the highlights of his interview with us at the end of the show. And he has a podcast episode that you can download on his Apple Chat podcast where you can listen to the entire interview, which I'll link to in the show notes. But you can stay tuned. If you want to just get the Cliff's notes or see what you can expect from the interview, you can stay tuned to the end, and Leander will give us the highlights, and then you can dive into the whole thing later. Before we hop into this week's best Apple news, let me go ahead and say thank you to Squarespace for supporting this episode. I use Squarespace for all my website needs, and you should too. I don't get it for free. I've been paying for it. That's how much I like it. I use it for thecultcast.com for some show notes. I use it for thecultcloth.co for the Cult Cloth e-commerce website. The first time I built a Squarespace website, I was totally surprised. It wasn't just easy, but the site, it was drag and drop. Everything was easy to customize, and it looked uniquely mine. I couldn't believe how good it looked. It looked like I had hired a developer and a designer to help build it for me. Once your site is up and running, you can bring in contributors to help you keep the site updated, which is so valuable. You have no idea, because if you have a custom website, you're constantly going to your developer and you have to wait on them to help them update it. No, you can do everything yourself. And like I said, everything is drag and drop, but totally customizable, so your site will look uniquely yours. Plus, Squarespace is constantly updating it with new features, new integrations, new templates to make your website look as good and run as well as it possibly can. And if you go to squarespace.com/cultcast, you can get started with a 2-week free trial, build a website, see how you like it. And at the end of your free trial, you can use code cultcast to continue your service and you will save 10% off your first purchase. Plus, if you buy a year of service, you will get an additional discount plus a free domain name at squarespace.com/cultcast. And the code to use at checkout is cultcast. Hey guys, real quick thing before we begin. I went to PAX West this last weekend. Whoo, baby, did I have a good time. It's one of the largest video game / board game conventions in the world. It's a wild time. Immediately after, I recorded a show with my good friend, the amazing Aaron Hughes. If you're interested in what PlayStation is doing, what Xbox is doing, what Nintendo is up to, if you like video games, if you like board games, I'm going to be releasing that conversation as a all-new Cultcast second hour, probably Friday, possibly Saturday, but this weekend at the very latest. It was a really fun episode, just me hanging out with my friend, talking about video games and board games and the state of the video game industry. So if you're interested, I'll be releasing that conversation as a separate episode by this weekend. So stay tuned for that. That should be out by Friday or Saturday. Lewis, I'm going to you first for perhaps the wackiest story of the week. This is in regards to the new iPhone 6.5-inch naming convention. Drop it on me, Lewis.
Yeah, this is kind of wacky. When it comes to naming this year's plus-size iPhone, Apple might be going to take it to the max.
Take it to the max!
Take it to the max. We've heard before Apple might ditch the plus name that they've been using ever since the 6. And now two different websites are citing anonymous sources saying that the name of the large iPhone this year, the one with the 6.5-inch OLED screen, is going to be called the iPhone XS Max.
A truly terrible naming convention, if you ask me.
The smaller 5.8-inch OLED model, which is like basically like exactly the same form factor as the current iPhone X, is supposedly going to be called the iPhone XS, and the cheaper 6.1-inch LED screen model might be the iPhone 9. You know, this is all a little bit like unconfirmed, but I really hope that this Max rumor is wrong. Especially since if they actually, you know, continue to pronounce it iPhone XS Max, I already want to call it the iPhone X. If they put an S on the end of it, I'm going to want to call it the iPhone XS. iPhone XS Max is just clunky. I wish they'd go with something simple like iPhone Pro or just, you know, iPhone.
The only way they can make this worse is if they call it the iPhone XS Extreme Edition. It's just so derivative. Max has been so played out. You can't put Max in the title. It's been used way too many times on way too many other products.
Well, what does it remind you of, Max?
It reminds me of Pepsi pills? Max.
Oh. it reminds me of being in a truck stop at 3 in the morning looking for something to keep me awake and seeing things exactly. I don't want to take. It gets tacky, kind of. Kind of reminds me of an Android phone. Ugh. I don't like it.
That is a very Android naming convention, isn't it? Plus just sounds so elegant and simple. It's the iPhone XS Plus.
Well, do you get the feeling this is all like, I think this is all Tim Cook just chucking shade at us. Because the original rumors that it was just going to be, they were all going to be called the iPhone XS, right? XS. And there was going to be no plus, no, you know, differentiation between the different models, just like they do with the MacBooks and the iPads. And that made a certain sense. I was like, that does make sense. And now it's gone from that to this really weird, you know, string of letters.
Maybe it'll just be iPhone X. Who knows?
I mean, yeah, I'm not sure I'd buy this story, quite honestly. Or I'm not sure Apple would carry on with the Max name.
There's also been kind of a few versions, haven't there? Because there's been like, you know, there's been talk about the XR, right, for the smaller one.
Right. Mm-hmm. What was that going to mean? Did you ever hear anybody explain that? What's R? Retrograde?
Rubbish? Ridiculous?
Somehow I don't think it stands for that.
Yeah, why are they R? I don't know. That doesn't make any sense. But then again, they called the, you know, the 5C. Remember that? That was a... What was the C? What did the C for?
Color.
Yeah. Oh, there you go. For color. Was it? Yeah. I don't know if that was officially it, but that makes sense.
Right. R. I mean, iPhone 10 or...
iPhone 10, is that the iPhone 10? God.
Yeah, I don't know, man. I hope that it is just a bunch of people playing strings, you know, or pulling people's strings, yanking people's chains, and that they, you know, but can't you just like, I mean, we're what, a week away from the event, and you know, at some point, it's going to be like, and here it is, the iPhone 10S Max. It's going to be a big screen. You're going to be, oh, God, it's true.
And that's when Tim Cook puts his hands to his mouth and yodels, "Take it to the max, y'all!"
maybe they'll That'd do that and day. Say, "Actually, we fooled you. We're just calling it the 10."
That would be a Craig Federighi joke for sure.
That would be sweet. Or maybe they'll, you know, the iPhone 10S Max Extreme. What would you say, Extreme? But yeah, that would be awesome. Maybe they just blah 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 blah. And they, nope, sorry.
Well, apparently the marketing team has been toying with getting rid of the plus moniker since iPhone 6 Plus came out in 2014. I don't know why. I really like the plus. I know that's like the fourth time I've said that, but we'll see what happens. We have a week to wait it out. I'm going to buy it regardless. It doesn't matter what they name it. They could name it the iPhone 10XS Turd Edition, and I'd still purchase one.
Comes in brown.
It could come in, yeah, exactly. Montezuma brown. And I'd still say, yeah, this is my phone, dude. I paid $1,200 for this phone. I'd still buy one and sell it all of you, so it doesn't really matter. Let's move on. So here's some good news. The 2018 iPhones could cost the same as the 2017 models. Here's another story I don't know if I buy, but let's just go through it. So we already know mostly everything about the newest phones. What we haven't known is how much they're going to cost. And that's something that we speculated on before. Are they going to be cheaper? Are they going to be more expensive? Because we have the plus size model coming out. Well, a report from the German website, Makrokauf, who starts by pointing out that the iPhone 8 costs €799. The iPhone 8 Plus sells for €909. And the iPhone 10 is €1,149. They said the 6.1-inch LCD iPhone is expected to be announced next week and will cost €799. Stay with me here. I'm going to break this down for dollars in a second. The 5.8-inch replacement for the iPhone 10 will be €909, and the 6.5-inch OLED iPhone will be €1,149. Well, if that assertion is correct, breaking it down into U.S. dollars, you actually can figure out how much this is going to cost you. The 6.1-inch LCD iPhone will cost $699. The speed-bumped 5.8-inch iPhone 10 replacement will be $799. And the 6.5-inch OLED model will be $999. These prices seem far too low to be believable. Dropping the price on all the phones, why would they drop the price when the iPhone 10 is already selling fine at its current price? That doesn't make sense to me. Leander, do you have any thoughts on this issue? And also, are you clicking your mouse in the background?
Yeah, sorry. I was like, Makrokauf? What the heck is that? And it's,
I was going to ask you guys if you're familiar with this.
Yeah, right. It's Makrokauf.
Makrokauf. My apologies.
Makrokauf. Good name. I don't know. You know, the last rumor I heard is they're going to keep the prices the same, not drop them. And when was the last time Apple dropped the prices? Usually they offer more for the same price, don't they? The time-tested model has been to keep the prices the same. Generally, they've dropped the prices a few times, I guess. The original iPhone, they dropped about $100, but that was really quick, you know, right after it came out of the gate, wasn't it?
And there was an outrage that that phone was too expensive. And the iPhone 10, we just found out, is selling wonderfully. So why would they go and drop the price on that phone and then price the iPhone 10S Plus Max Extreme Edition at $999? That doesn't make any sense. Like, the Plus always commands a premium.
They'd love to drop the prices, I'm sure, if they could keep the margins up. You know, I think getting the price down is beneficial to them. You know, they'll bring in more customers for sure. As you say, they have no trouble selling, you know, the iPhone 10 right now for $1,200 or whatever it is. But I think, you know, if they even if they dropped it $100 or $200, you know, that would definitely bring, that would just juice sales. How could that hurt sales by making it cheaper? You know what I mean? So I think making it cheaper would, but you know, they want to maintain the margins. And at the moment, I mean, I was just looking at the numbers. You know, Apple's making 40% margins on their products, which is, you know, madness.
Wow.
So much money. So if they can maintain the margins, I'm sure they'd love to drop the prices. But yeah, I'm a bit skeptical. It's not really in their playbook.
I would be ecstatic if they did this. I don't want to spend $1,200 on the larger iPhone model. I'm not sure I could stomach that. I mean, I probably will no matter what.
You will no matter what, right?
I wouldn't be happy about it, but let's be honest. I'm going to do it.
I mean, you know, to be honest, they can charge almost whatever they want, right? I mean, people are still going to pay it.
Well, no, there's a limit. I think if they came out with a base model phone that cost $1,300, people would not be able to stomach that.
Yeah, but they did that with the with the iPhone X. That was like the one, you know, the first one to really break that $1,000 barrier.
That's true. And the maxed out one, I think, cost close to $1,300.
Yeah, yeah. So people said exactly the same thing, but, you know, it's been selling like gangbusters.
Right. And for guys like us, you know, the big ballers, we don't care what the price is, right, Lewis?
Well,
I'll tell you, I was a little stunned that when they came out with the $1,000 one, you know, and but as I've always said, you know, you get it on that monthly payment plan. It's really not that much of a difference.
That's how they get you.
Just not that different.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't think I want a bigger phone anyway, man. I'm pretty pleased with the size of this, the 10.
I am too, for the most part, but I can always go bigger.
God, I saw a friend. He has a 6 Plus or 6S Plus or something. He has it in one of those OtterBox cases. It
looked
freaking, I don't know. I put mine beside it, and it looked tiny. But the screen's the same, you know? What do you do with that? You need, like, a bag for that thing. I don't know.
Yeah, or a fanny pack.
Whew. Man,
yeah, it's a big boy, yeah, especially in the OtterBox.
Got these little tiny, you know, shrimp hands. I'm
pretty. Oh, you got Alex E. Heath hands over there?
Yeah.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
Well, there you have it. Take it for what it's worth. We might get cheaper iPhones. I'm hoping for that. But again, I don't necessarily buy that Apple would do this. I think Leander pointed out correctly that Apple generally offers more value for the price rather than lowering prices. And I don't see a reason market-wise why they would lower prices on these phones. It doesn't make any sense to me. I mean, would they sell more? Yeah, they would. And I guess if they could maintain their margins, maybe they've somehow decreased the price of the components. I'm sure they decrease the price of the components every year, but this is a drastic decrease. I mean, this would be a large decrease. This is a 20% price drop on these phones. So I find it hard to buy that they're going to do this. Anyway, let's pivot over to Apple Watch. Now, normally I don't talk about patents because they're boring and you never really know what's going to happen in the future. But Apple had a patent this week that I thought was really interesting, and it included a feature that I've always wanted for the Apple Watch. I think it's probably the Apple Watch's biggest weakness. It's something that I've complained about on the show endlessly. It bugs me about the Apple Watch so much, and that is the fact that the Apple Watch doesn't have an always-on screen. And some people are bothered by this less than me. That's great. But when I turn my wrist, if my watch doesn't come on immediately, I instantly become annoyed. In the 500 milliseconds it takes for the screen to come on, my blood pressure goes up 15 points. It's absolutely annoying to me. And it makes me want to wear a normal watch because you're constantly churning your wrist, at least I am, and then waiting for the Apple Watch to churn itself on and tell you the time. And I hate that. Well, Apple knows this is a problem and they are working on fixing it. And a new patent application reveals that they may have figured something out. It's a feature that would give the Apple Watch the ability to have the watch stay on all the time. But what the patent is addressing is the OLED burn-in problem. Because with OLEDs, the problem is if the screen stays on all the time and it's not constantly in movement, so there aren't pixels moving all around, that screen image can get burned into the screen and can display those pixels even when you don't want them to be displayed. This is a huge problem with OLED televisions, and this is one of the reasons why I never bought an OLED TV, because it's a problem that they just can't fix with OLEDs. And I was thinking that maybe Apple was going to fix this issue when they moved to micro LEDs, which is something that they're currently working on. Micro LEDs have a lot of the benefits of OLED and LCD together. And I thought that Apple would solve this problem that way, but maybe they are going to try to implement an OLED solution. That's what the patent addresses. I can't imagine they're going to get this to market before they move to micro LED, which I think is probably going to happen in the next 3 years or so, maybe 5 years. It depends. But in any case, I'm going to be a very happy man once they are able to address this issue, because I want my watch to be on all the time. Churning your wrist. Do you wear your Apple Watch, Lewis? You wear it pretty regularly, don't you? All the time. Does it bother you when you turn your wrist and then just nothing happens for a split second?
Yeah, and even worse is when I raise it and then I'm trying to like if you're wearing like a coat and you're trying to like move the sleeve back, and as you do that, it turns off again, and you're like, oh God, all I want to do is just do this one thing. that is annoying. I do not like that. And I've heard, you know, like Bob Left sits at, I don't know if you know that guy. He's pretty comical writer about the music industry, and he's an Apple fan, but he took his Apple Watch back because that was the reason. He's like, I'm sitting there lying on my back and I'm doing my exercise and I want to do this, and I go to check my watch and it won't turn on. That's
something I hear people complain about quite often when I talk to people about their Apple Watch, is that the screen doesn't stay on long enough, or it doesn't turn on when they turn their wrist.
Yeah, it's
that's
true.
The first time I've heard anyone say they missed their window, though, when they're trying to get their jacket sleeve.
You never had that happen. I have it all the time.
No, but I've got long arms, so I think maybe it has something to do with your the size of your arms. Like maybe your jacket sleeve is just all bunched up, so you're trying to like pull the fabric up, and by the time you get to it, the watch shuts off. Like me, I just raise my arm.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I find it all the time. There's one specific thing I like to do, a little complication, a little HomeKit thing that, you know, of course, when you want to come home and open your door, you have it unlocked, you have to raise your thing, and I'm getting off my motorcycle, I raise my wrist, a little thing says, hi, do you want to run this thing? Because, of course, it won't do it because it's protecting me from the door unlocking on its own. And I say, yeah, I do, and I'm trying to move it, and God, and then it goes black. And then I got to move. You know, these are minor problems, I realize, but it's happened frequently.
I was just thinking the other day, this is going to be an expensive month. I bought the new MacBook Pro, which I'm using right now to record the show for the first time ever, by the way.
Ooh,
the
maiden awesome.
Voyage. And what episode are we on? 352. So that's when I broke in my new MacBook Pro for its maiden voyage. I'm going to break a bottle of champagne over it later.
over the keyboard. Good idea.
I'm going to make sure I purchase AppleCare Plus first before I do that. And I was thinking, I don't think I can resist. The new iPads, when they come out, I'm getting one for sure. I bought my other iPad in 2013. It still works great, but it's like when you have a jacket that you've owned for 5 years and it still works. It still keeps you warm, but everyone else is wearing the new cool tight jacket and they're waxing their mustache and looking really hipster and you're feeling like you're out of place. I think I need to upgrade to the new iPad and the Apple Watch. If it looks like the one in that picture, which it almost certainly will, I think I'm on board for that too. I don't even want to add it all up.
The Apple Watch is almost more exciting than the phone.
You think it is?
I'm really excited by the new Apple Watch.
I'm excited to see what they announce for it. It's going to depend on what features are included. If the marquee feature is just a bigger screen, which my guess is that is going to be the one and only big feature, then that's exciting for me, but I use my phone so much, I don't think it overshadows the new phones because I really want a larger phone. But to each their own, Leander.
Yeah. Well, it's a pretty close race for sure. Like you said, you know, like I think the larger screen is going to be it. There might be some improved heart rate sensing, like an EKG, right? Wasn't that one of the rumors?
It seems like that's something that they're always working on.
Yeah. I'm really waiting for like the glucose monitoring. That's the one thing I really want to see.
That would be a game changer. Can you imagine?
Yeah. Oh, sure.
I mean, really, every time, especially if you're diabetic, but even if you're not diabetic, if you've got information on your blood glucose and you found out that you're like pre-diabetic or something, which a lot of people are and they don't even know it. And it would allow people to like lose weight. I know a girl, she was pre-diabetic. She lost 40 pounds, something like that. And now she's fine. And it was all just from realizing that she needed to change her lifestyle. I mean, think how impactful that would be for people to have that information. Plus, I mean, I have family members who are diabetic, and having to prick your finger all the time, it's terrible. It's just a little prick several times a day, but your fingers are sensitive. And having to do that all day, every day is just, it's a prison sentence. It's really awful. It's really awful. And you hate to see people have to go through that. So if they could come out with a piece of technology that could do it without having to go through any pain, that would be incredible. That would be incredible. Okay. Before we talk about this interview you did, Leander, oh, let me first mention this. I want to plug a really cool Kickstarter by my friend Roberto Hoyos. We used to do a podcast together, gosh, years ago now. I want to say keep it friendly to all of you out there who used to listen to the podcast. Well, Roberto is known for being the founder of Throwboy. He started a cool pillow company, a geeky pillow company, and they make all sorts of like Apple-themed pillows they have over the years. They had a Icon pillow set, which he launched with years ago, which kind of got the company started. Well, he has a new pillow set that recreates some of Apple's most iconic hardware. And let's see, I had the list here in front of me, but let me pull up this link. So I think it recreates the iPod. It has the spinning wheel of death. I think there's the Apple.
That's what made me laugh.
That one did?
Yeah, that made me laugh out loud. I almost got it just because of that.
It's a bonus, right? A Kickstarter bonus.
Yeah, a bonus spinning wheel of death.
Yeah, and he has like the Apple II, the Mac Classic. These things look great. They look just like the vintage Apple products that we all know and love. They're extraordinarily well made. I've been friends with Roberto for a long time. He used to make these pillows by hand in his apartment, and now he has them manufactured. They are very good quality, and he's been doing this for so long now. He's really polished his craft, and he has a great product. And so if you haven't checked these out, I'll link to them on Cultimac. You can see we did two stories about them, I think. And they've been all over the web. I think The Verge did an article on them. All sorts of the best blogs on the internet have written about these because they're so cool. And his Kickstarter, he was trying to raise $10,000, I think. And he's currently at $67,000. $67,000. Brother Roberto's buying a Tesla after this Kickstarter ends. That's for sure. He's going to get himself like a Model S or something.
That's the kind of money that he skips out, right? Though, you know, he heads out of Mexico and then he never see you.
That's your right. You'll never get your pillow again, and he'll just be living the life. Well, this is not his first Kickstarter. Unlike other Kickstarters, you're all but guaranteed to get your pillow. I think he's done this two, maybe even three times before, and he actually has his fulfillment all set up. I think he's basically just doing this to actually kickstart the project and get the funds to actually build these and ship them all out, and to also see what kind of demand you're going to have. That's the best part about Kickstarter, is people tell you exactly what they want, and you don't have to carry a stock. You just order exactly what people ordered, and so then you can just ship them all out. So for him, I have full confidence that you'll actually get your pillows if you decide to support this. Plus, you get a discount because you're ordering them early. So we'll all link to this in the show notes if you want to check them out. These are the new vintage. I don't think he calls them the vintage Mac pillows. I don't know what he calls them. The vintage computer pillows or something. He's very careful to not mention Apple or any of Apple's products in the description, which is smart, because I don't know about you guys, but if I got a knock on my door and an Apple lawyer standing there, I would pee myself a little bit. They've got endless resources, and I'm sure they have the best lawyers in the biz. Okay, before we jump into your interview with Ken Cosienda, let me also say thank you to LinkedIn for supporting this episode. You know, the right hire can make a huge impact on your business. That's why it's important for you to find the right person. Look at Cultimac. It is a well-oiled machine. You've got me doing work for them. You've got Lewis. You've got Buster. You don't just find high-skilled personnel like this. You got to be real lucky like Leander Keeney, or you got to use the right resource to find great people like LinkedIn. It is the world's largest professional network. You knew that. People go to LinkedIn every day to grow professionally and discover job opportunities. 70% of the workforce in the U.S. is already there. Well, LinkedIn Jobs matches people to your role based on who they really are, their skills, their interests, and even how they are open to new opportunities. Most LinkedIn members haven't recently visited the top job boards, but 9 out of 10 members are open to new opportunities, so you can only reach them on LinkedIn. That's why a new hire is made every 10 seconds using LinkedIn, and businesses rate LinkedIn 40% higher than job boards at delivering high-quality candidates. Here's what you should do. Are you looking for a new employee? Are you looking for someone of a high caliber? Are you looking for the next me or the next Lewis? Well, good luck finding them. But if they're out there, they're undoubtedly on LinkedIn. You can go over to linkedin.com/cultcast and get $50 off your first job post. linkedin.com/cultcast, and you'll get $50 off your first job post. Terms and conditions do apply. linkedin.com/cultcast. Leander, You made time from your busy schedule to do another podcast episode of Apple Chat, the iconic interviews with people from the Apple industry. This time, you interviewed Ken Kosienda. What, I guess he had a new book come out, is that right?
That's right, yeah. Ken was a programmer with Apple for 15 years during the sort of, you know, that what he calls a golden age of Steve Jobs. So he started like in 2001 and just quit this sort of like about a year ago and wrote a book about his experience there. And he was initially hired on to do the Safari web browser, which also led to WebKit, which is a sort of underlying technology, which is part of the operating system and is actually used by a whole bunch of things, including the iPhone. And then he went on to help program parts of the first iPhone, but in particular the keyboard. And then he went on to work on the iPad and the Apple Watch. And the book is, I thought it was like, it's one of the best books about Apple, one of the great books about Apple, you know, like it's only from a true insider perspective. And I thought it was comparable to Lawrence Levy's book about Pixar, to Pixar and Beyond.
Wow, that's high praise.
Which, you know, what I liked about him is that I think there's a lot of mystique about Apple, you know, there's a lot of mythology about it, especially about Steve Jobs and the iPhone. And I think a lot of people think that, you know, Jobs dreamed up the iPhone and that he had, you know, the people working at Apple make it. But as Ken's book, you know, really clearly step by step lays out, you know, Jobs had a super important role, but a lot of the ideas came from the ground up, the rank and file. Hmm. And through this methodology that he describes, that he calls creative selection, which, you know, this process distills, and it sort of answers that question about, you know, like, will Apple be okay without Steve Jobs? And it's kind of like, yeah, it will, because they have this process, this creative process, you know, that will see them through. And the process is one of demos. And that they, if a program had an idea, the thing they had to do immediately was whip up a demo of the idea. So immediately they made the idea concrete. You know, they didn't put it on a whiteboard. They didn't give a talk about it. There's no sort of brainstorming, no offsites. You know, it's just this culture of, you know, if you have an idea, make a demo of it and show it to someone.
Hmm.
So often they would show it to like their coworker and they'd say, here, what do you think of this? And then the coworker said, well, this is good, but this doesn't really work. So whatever that criticism was, he'd fix it. And then the next demo, you know, he would get further feedback. And the demos would go on and on. You know, they'd go from coworker to coworker, then to managers. They'd show it in groups, in a group session. Like once a week, they'd probably have a session where they'd all get together and demo each work to each other. And it would go up the pyramid eventually until it got to Steve Jobs. And so Scott Forstall, who was the manager in charge of the iOS development team, you know, he every couple of weeks or whatever it took, or whatever it was, once a week, once twice a week, every couple of weeks, would choose things to show Steve Jobs. And Jobs, you know, would give his feedback on it. And it would often be the one sort of making a decision. You know, so they make the big decisions sort of at the executive level. But this process, you know, is really productive and really allows things to move forward. It really gave things momentum and made things concrete. You know, so they weren't always like talking about ideas. They were making things and distilling it, critiquing it, improving it. And, you know, eventually, you know, it would build up into... It would accumulate until it came out with things like, you know, iOS and a product like the iPhone. So I thought it was really fascinating and really, really well done. Some people might find it a bit slow, maybe. I like the fact that it demystifies the whole process. It makes it seem really quite straightforward, something that anybody could do.
Mm-hmm. Do they use this process for hardware and software?
Well, yeah, Ken doesn't discuss this in his book, but, you know, it reminded me of, you know, my own book about Johnny Ive and their prototyping process. And it's exactly the same thing in the product, you know, with the hardware. Johnny Ive's industrial design team does exactly the same thing. It's entirely analogous. You know, they turn sketches into 3D prototypes. They have all this kind of 3D prototyping machinery in their own studio. And then they refine the prototypes. They live with the prototypes. They start fiddling with them. They put them in their pockets. You know, they walk around with them. And they constantly refine their prototypes. And it's exactly analogous to the software process.
Imagine being able to come up with an idea and then have a laboratory full of manufacturing equipment where you could just go build it and just carry it around in your pocket. I mean, that might be, I'm sure that is a significant part of Apple's secret sauce, is just the fact that they can create a product and iterate on it without having to go and seek anyone's help. They can just do that all in their own design laboratory.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. You know, but it's this process of constantly, of, well, you know, creative selection. The reason they call it creative selection is because he said it was a Darwinian process. Hmm. You know, they select the best features, and those features get to live on to the next demo. So it's akin to Darwinian selection. But it's a creative. So he called it creative selection. The title, I think, is a bit, you know, it, you have to read the book to sort of really grok what he means. Mm-hmm. But and he talks a little bit. There were some other elements to it. Like, he talked about taste and decision making. He outlined sort of seven things that also came into the process, which I thought were a little more ephemeral. So I didn't really, you know, concentrate on those so much. I just thought the process, you know, this process of iterating, of creating demos and then iterating, was interesting, because I think it's a lesson that everyone, it's the same as the editing process too, with writing. I think with any creative process, like a lot of creative people, they do this, you know, they create and they edit, create and edit, create and edit. But, you know, the thing he laid out in the book was, you know, very, like, a lot of talk about how the team worked together and how a lot of the ideas, you know, came from, well, from failure. You know, they were trying to do something. Like, the bulk of the book is talking about the iPhone keyboard. And it seems, you know, the iPhone keyboard, you know, so what? It's a QWERTY keyboard. It's like, what's the big deal? And it seems very straightforward to us now. But at the time, you know, they were really, really concentrated. This was one of the key elements, because they knew it was going to be the primary input mechanism for the iPhone and a software keyboard, you know, on the screen. Because unlike the BlackBerrys at the time, you know, it didn't have any hard keys. Mm-hmm. And they were worried it was going to turn out like the Newton, you know, with the handwriting recognition. The handwriting recognition on the Newton didn't work, and it doomed the product. And so they were worried about the keyboard. Like, if the keyboard didn't work, it could doom the iPhone. So they made some early QWERTY keyboards, and they just didn't work. It was too hard to hit the keys on such a tiny screen. And, you know, even with you know, like someone like Lewis with his little prawn fingers, you know, like it was difficult.
Way to throw that jab in there.
Ouch!
So they had this big, you know, like, it wasn't working, and it was like, this is a month or two into the project, and it was like, you know, Scott Foster came and said, okay, one of Foster's lieutenants, Henri, said, okay, everyone stop what you're doing. This isn't working. We've got to fix the keyboard. From now on, everyone on the team, like about a dozen people, everyone's a keyboard engineer. Everyone come up with their best keyboard, and in 2 weeks we'll have a big bake-off. So in 2 weeks they had this bake-off, and it turned out that Ken had the winning idea.
But you're kidding me! It was Ken's idea to have, like, the algorithm that predicts, like, where your thumb's going to land and which key you're trying to land on?
Right, exactly. Yeah,
we talked about this on a previous show.
Oh, okay. Well, was I there?
Yeah, I think so.
Were you awake?
I think you were there. Whether you're awake or not, that I can't answer. Okay. But this is one of my favorite stories we've ever told, about how it was crunch time, the iPhone was getting ready to ship, they still didn't have a keyboard ready.
Well, this is earlier in the process in his book anyway.
Okay.
Not quite at the end.
Still, but, though, the fact that it was Ken who is the one who was able to get the keyboard working and make it so that the iPhone could predict where your finger was actually trying to land based on what you had typed previously. That was a great story.
Yeah, absolutely. And it has everything to do with autocorrect. You know, like this, having a dictionary of words and trying to predict, you know, what word you're trying to type. Because if you actually look at what you actually type, it's mostly gibberish. Even now, it's gibberish.
Yeah.
You know, like you're not hitting the keys you think you're hitting. But the autocorrect, you know, does a great job of predicting what you think, what it thinks you're typing, and putting it up. And of course, you know, like, and so it'll actually change the, if you're typing the one of the most, you know, the most common word in the language, if you type TH, then it's pretty sure you're going to go for an E. So it enlarges behind the scenes the target for the letter E. You know, it takes over all the surrounding letters around it. So
as long as your finger gets close to the E,
close to it,
will select the E as your next letter.
You can hit a letter, yeah, either side of it, above or below it, and it'll register it as an E. So it's actually really fiendishly clever. But it took him a year to figure this out, or a year to make it and make it work. And make it work well. And the result is that it does work really remarkably well. It works really, really well. It's, you know, but it's surprisingly complex behind the scenes. It has a complexity that, you know, and I thought the book did a great job of laying out, like, you know, what problem he had, how they solved it, and how it progressed. And, you know, when I said earlier, people might find it a bit slow, it may be a little bit laborious, because, you know, he talks a lot about programming and this creative select, methodology, and he's talking about the keyboard, and it does take up like a big bulk of the book, but I thought it was fascinating the way it lays it out step by step. And his thinking is really clear, his writing is really clear. I learned a lot about programming and programming methodology. I thought it was, you know, I thought it was really, really, really well done. The thing you don't get is you don't get this kind of like the big picture, you know, because he was, I mean, he didn't even see the hardware. They had these little, what they called wallabies, like little plastic screened facsimiles of the iPhone that were tethered to a Power Mac that provided all the processing power. They were tapping away on this little screen, but it didn't have any electronic guts. So he didn't even see the phone until after Steve Jobs announced it. You know, they brought up a prototype that was like bulging at the seams because they couldn't get all the components to fit inside. But it doesn't give you that big picture of like all the different things that went on, you know, to develop the iPhone. It just concentrates on his contribution. But you get a good flavor for, like, you know, how Scott Forstall's team developed iOS and all the challenges they had, and, you know, everything was a problem. Everything was new. No one had ever done this before, you know, making a buttonless, you know, device that could do so many different things. You know, that was actually essentially a computer in your pocket. And one of the other things, and there's a bunch of revelations, you know, like one of the things I, you know, was really surprising was Scott Forstall, his portrayal of Scott Forstall.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Scott Forstall, if people don't know this, he was the head of iOS development. He was pegged at one time to be like the mini Steve, the CEO in waiting, the one who was probably going to, you know, take over as CEO when Steve Jobs died. But of course, it went to Tim Cook, and then Tim Cook canned him in 2012, like about less than a year after Tim Cook took over. And since then, his reputation has really sort of suffered. You know, like, I think, there's been a lot of rumored reports about his careerism and how political he was and how he sort of backstabbed people. And
so he was like Steve Jobs.
I guess. Right. But in the book, he comes across as a really great manager, you know, like as a really, 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 really thoughtful guy, really, really helpful, really concerned about his team, protected him a lot, always had a word of encouragement. Some of the reports too about the iPhone, you know, like Fred Vogelstein did a report, one of the early reports about the iPhone development, and it was all about drama and stress and, you know, people burning out. But Ken's book, you know, makes it seem very sort of not relaxed, but, you know, not crazy either.
Not as frantic.
Not as frantic, right, exactly, yeah. They're sort of, you know, they're working steadily, progressing steadily. It was like, it was a long, long march, and definitely people did burn out, because I think almost all the team that were responsible for this are no longer there, just like with the original Mac, you know, the Mac development team.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it was really, you know, it's one of the few books where you get a real feel for what it was like to work at Apple.
Well, aside from the book, we also need to plug your podcast episode that you did. What was this, last week?
This week. I just published it earlier this week.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Still fresh. So we'll post the link to it in the show notes so people can go
Chat.
Check it out.
You can find it on, you know, iTunes and any podcast player.
Okay, great. We'll link to it in iTunes too, and I'm sure you talk.
He talks about a lot of stuff. You know, Steve Jobs. Apple.
Any other programming highlights of the conversation you want to highlight?
he's good. He asked him a bunch of questions. He lays out this creative selection process, and mm-hmm. he talks what it was like, you know, to work there. And we talked a little bit about, you know, how does he feel about Apple going forward under Tim Cook. We touched on a lot of stuff
because he's not there anymore, right? He's gone.
No, he quit.
So he can be frank.
You were Frankish. Yeah.
He can tell you what he really thinks. The secret dirt about Tim Cook you've never heard. That should be the headline.
There's no dirt. You know, that's one of the things. I don't know if people would be disappointed about that or not, you know, because there's no, you know, he, there's no sort of there's no dirty revelations. It's it's about his work, and it's very straightforward. But I enjoyed it nonetheless.
I love that kind of stuff too. I like to know the inside track at Apple because they're doing stuff that no one else is doing. So I want to know more about their creative process. I want to know more about the creative selection that you talked about, and how do they go from no product, just an idea, to a finished product that takes over the world, like the iPhone. Like, that's valuable information.
Right, absolutely. And you know, I think one of the things I think that maybe counts against it is that, you know, it's myth busting, and I think people like myths. We were talking. I was talking with Luke, who did a review of Lisa Brennan, Steve Jobs' daughter's new book, Small Fry, which is a memoir, you know, of her childhood and how awful Steve Jobs was, you know, to her, to his own daughter, how cruel he was. And, you know, when we're discussing, it's like, I don't want to read that book. You know, I already know that Steve's a dick, but I don't want it pushed in my face. You know, like, I want to live with a happy myth. I don't want to, you know what I mean? It's like,
yeah,
I don't want the details of how awful a human being he was. I'd rather have the positive stuff. I want a myth. I don't want the real Steve Jobs. I want the mythical Steve Jobs. I'll never read that book because of that.
It's the same reason I don't like following the actors I like on Twitter, because I don't want to know what they're really like. You know, it's just gonna ruin it. Anytime I do it, I'm inevitably left wanting and completely disappointed when I know their true opinions about so many different matters.
Well, that's exactly right. That's exactly it. And so I was wondering whether this book would suffer from the same thing, because it's kind of myth busting, you know, like it makes it seem very, very normal, very, very straightforward, you know, something almost anybody could do. Mm-hmm. And the myth is better, you know, like a book that held the myth about, you know, Steve Jobs dreaming of the iPhone and cracking the whip on his team and screaming and raving and shouting and fighting and stress and, you know, everything coming up to the last minute, nothing works. And then finally, oh, amazing. You know, it's like, it's brilliant and the world loves it. That's a better story. The myth is better, isn't it?
Absolutely. Every time. No one wants to know the real story. The real story is always more mundane and boring.
Right. It's, you know, meetings.
Yeah, exactly.
Demos. I don't know. I found it. I liked it though. I thought it was, you know, and Laurence Olivier's book as well about Pixar, I think, is another great one as well, because last minute, it's just a series of conversations with Steve and how they took, you know, Pixar that was really flailing around. It was like really looking for a business model. Nothing was working. How they got into making movies, how they made the movie a huge success, and then how he became super rich, you know, from taking the company public after that. And Levy really lays out, you know, like the 2 or 3 years he worked there, the conversations that they had. And again, it busts the myth. It makes it seem very straightforward. The problems are really carefully laid out. The solutions they came up with weren't especially, they were clever, you know, they were rational. They were obviously, you know, they were the things you would obviously do given how they laid out the problem. You know, they weren't like the things that a genius would do, right? Just, I'm sorry, I'm going on and on, but...
No, that's fine. I love hearing about this stuff. And so I'll link to the episode and the post in the show notes, so you guys can go check out the post Cult of Mac, and then you can go listen to the episode on iTunes, or I think you also have it on SoundCloud. So we'll make sure people have the links that they need to go listen to that episode. I think we should go ahead and wrap it up there. The Apple 30-minute Apple conversation has officially reached 60 minutes, which is our cue to go ahead and wrap it up. That's all the CultCast we have for you guys this week. But if you want to come say hi or reach out about any of the stories we mentioned in today's show, we're all on Twitter. I'm at Airfun. Leander is at L. Caney. Lewis is at Lewis Walls. This has been the CultCast, the best 30-plus minute Apple conversation you're going to hear all week long. New episodes of the CultCast come out every Thursday night. We never miss. I want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll see you guys next time. Nicely, and that's great.
Wait, really?
Yeah, I can't wait to go check that out.
I thought I was going on and 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 on.
Well, you were. But I got a really great power nap in there, and I feel refreshed.
Cool. Okay, great. Let's see who says that.
Yeah, but that guy's a chode.
Yeah, absolutely. What is a chode, by the way? I tried to look that up the other day.
It's the piece of skin that connects your bollocks to your butt.
What?
Yeah, it's the taint.
Taint?
Oh, the taint.
Yeah, yeah. It's a much really? Better way to say it, though. Yeah, it's a chode.
Okay. Okay, glad I asked. Thanks.
Hey, you taught me what aubergine meant. It's the least I could do for you.
Yeah, that's right, aubergine.
Oh, my God.